Well, thank you very much indeed for inviting me here, Maitri and the committee. It's great to be here. This is an organization I've heard of for a couple of years, but had never visited, so it's, I'm delighted to be here to see the kind of work that you're already engaged in, and to, as it were, stop by for a while with you and throw in a few hands worth of thoughts to help you along your way. So I'm glad that Maitri mentioned the vision statement of NCPG. I do recommend you read that, and I'm going to use that as my starting point. It's an excellent vision statement of what integration of faith and learning is about. I also see from that, and also from the Christian Postgraduate and Postdoctoral Researchers Facebook, which you should also visit, that many people, and probably many of you here, are already deep into discussion about what it means to be a Christian postgraduate and to integrate faith and scholarship. And that's really exciting. There's some excellent material on those sites, actually, and I really would urge you to make use of it and read it and then add to it. This is a great way to share all kinds of resources that will help us along our way. It's also very encouraging to see a number of postgraduate fellowships, Christian fellowships, appearing on several campuses around the UK, bringing Christians together to reflect on the distinctive challenges faced in the secular academy. And I think what we see developing here, very excitingly, is the formation of new kinds of networks and communities of emerging Christian scholars beginning to find their calling together as servants of Jesus Christ in the academy. And let me say that when I use the term Christian scholars, I mean basically everybody in this room, not just faculty, but postgraduates, really anybody involved in the project of university education. And it's very exciting to think where this might lead over the next decade or so. I was particularly struck, looking at the Facebook page, I think, of the Christian Academic Manifesto. Anybody here had a hand in that? Anybody want to own up to... Ah, right, okay, good. It's an excellent initiative, and I'd certainly commend it to you. Take a look at that. It's an emerging document, is that right? You're sort of building it as you go along. Gradually, yeah, yeah. Well, who knows what might come out of that? When it takes some serious shape, perhaps out of it will come something like a strategic plan for this organization over the next 10, 20, 25 years, or 30 years. That seems a long way away when most of you are concerned about, can I get through my PhD in the next year or two? But as I'll explain tonight and tomorrow, we are right now correcting a very deep deficiency in the Christian mind, going back centuries, actually, not just decades. So we have to learn to think in decades, at least, and not be in a hurry for quick victories or instant results. We're part of a larger community of the people of God in the academy, coursing through time. And God has given us this moment to do the tasks that he has given each of us to do, to contribute to that movement of renewal, the end result of which we can't foresee, we can't predict, and in any case, it's in God's hands. So that by way of introduction. Let me start by digging into the vision statement a little bit of NCPG by looking particularly at Romans 12, 1-2. I want to say a little bit about that. So our task this weekend is to delve further into what it means for our minds to be transformed. Oh, by the way, let me say one other thing. Thank you to the worship leaders for leading us in what I would call integrated worship, all of life redeemed worship, and grown-up worship. Thank you very, very much for that. We don't get enough of that in our churches today. So I'll look forward to tomorrow and the next day. So our task is to explore what it means for our minds to be transformed. Well, you all know the Romans passage. It was read to us a little earlier, but I'll just read those first two verses again, refresh your memories. And I do this because, as you probably know, these two verses have become a kind of charter for Christian scholarship. Many people, Christian scholars, over a long period of time have invoked this particular verse, these two verses, as a sort of foundation document to mandate, to legitimate and to inspire the task of Christian scholarship. So in my version it says this: I appeal to you therefore, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds, so that you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Now, although this is a kind of charter, or has become looked to as a kind of charter for Christian scholarship, let me make three comments on these first few verses. The first is this: in verse 2, the word for mind actually doesn't refer to what we do as Christian scholars. It doesn't refer to the specialized reasoning involved in academic work. It rather refers to the whole person viewed from the standpoint of their internal intentions. It's a what you might call a whole of life word. So Paul is saying our whole lives are to be transformed by a process of renewal, so that we won't conform to the futile ways of a fallen world, but instead will know and intend the will of God for what is good and acceptable and perfect. And let me just say that the word perfect there doesn't mean literally flawless or unimprovable, but mature and wholesome. And it's wholesome because it's flowing out of a life being made whole by the indwelling Christ. Well, the academic task is just one corner of that whole of life task of renewal. But it too must undergo the same process of transformation, so that we begin to discern what kinds of academic activity are good and acceptable and perfect before God. Second, note too that in verse 1, by contrast, Paul speaks of our bodies. So in verse 2 he speaks of minds, but in verse 1 he speaks of our bodies being a living sacrifice. And again, the word body here doesn't refer simply to our physical bodies, but, like all biblical words about the human person, it refers to the whole person, but this time viewed from the standpoint of its materiality. And so the appeal here is that we should become living sacrifices in every part of our embodied creatureliness, every dimension of what it means to be an embodied creature living under God. So this is a charter for academic life, but simply in the sense that it's a charter for the whole of life, the renewal of the whole of life in Christ. Third point, but let's read on now and see what Paul says in the next verses, verses 3 to 8. Let me just read those verses. You should always interpret individual verses in the light of what goes before and what follows. So let's see what follows. Not what we might expect. I mean, frankly, if this was a charter for scholarship, we'd expect Paul to go on to talk about scholarship. Wouldn't it be nice if he'd done so? Wouldn't it be great if we'd actually had those purple passages that we can wave around and prove to everybody else that scholarship is really so important in the Christian life? He doesn't do that, so we have to go where he goes. This is what he says: for by the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you, not to think of yourself more highly than you ought to think. Clunk. Okay, that's not what we were hoping for. But to think with sober judgment, each according to the measure of faith that God has assigned. And then here we get one of these several New Testament Pauline lists of gifts, callings, charisms that Paul includes in his letters on several occasions. For as in one body we have many members, and not all the members have the same functions, so we who are many are one body in Christ and individually members one of another. We have gifts that differ according to the grace given to us: prophecy in proportion to faith, ministry in ministering, the teacher in teaching, the exhorter in exhortation, the giver in generosity, the leader in diligence, the compassionate in cheerfulness. Now, so what Paul is doing here is not talking at this point about the totality of life. That's what he's talked about in verses 1 to 2. He's now talking about the diversity of gifts given to us as members of the body of Christ. And I think what we can get from this is the idea that the Christian life isn't just a sort of generic call to faithfulness without content. It's a call to faithfulness in the concrete particulars of our various callings, giftings, vocations. Now here, obviously, Paul is writing to a local church. He's listing gifts or roles that come to the fore within the church community itself. But let me make a hermeneutical move here, which I'll defend later on if you wish, and suggest that this must apply far more comprehensively to life as a whole, life beyond the redeemed community of the church. Indeed, I'd suggest that it points to the diversity of gifts deriving from our created humanity, has a much wider potential range of meaning. Well, obviously, in this list, Paul doesn't single out the academic life per se, but I suggest that the life of the academic can perhaps be seen as a specialised form of what he calls here teaching. So one word to Christian postgrads, to all of us actually, is this, verse 3. Think with sober judgment about your academic giftings, and come to see the academic calling as one among many of the things you are gifted to do in following Christ. No more important, but no less. And now let me make another hermeneutical move that you may wish to challenge, but it seems to me to leap straight out of the page here. The problem that Paul was addressing in Romans, quite clearly, was that the Roman Christians were getting above themselves. That was the pastoral issue that he was addressing. So that's the angle on that passage. Don't get above yourselves. Think with sober judgment. Don't think more highly of yourselves than you ought to think. But the challenge facing Christian scholars today, particularly young emerging Christian scholars, is much more likely, I think, to be the risk of what we might call too low vocational self-esteem. We have a different pastoral problem that we're struggling with. Given the marginalisation of the Christian mind in the academy and the relative disinterest in Christian scholarship in many churches and in many Christian organisations, and sad to say in some Christian student organisations, we often are led to doubt the value of our work. We're led to doubt whether we're up to the challenge. We're led to doubt whether we can ever win respect in the secular academy, if that's a goal that we should pursue. So I think our need, actually, today, is to recover a proper confidence in the dignity of our calling as Christian scholars, and therefore not to think too lowly of ourselves as Christian scholars. And here I think we can recall the words of Paul to Timothy, who, as you may know, himself, for various reasons, struggled with issues of confidence. Hence, Paul is continually exhorting him to deal with that. In 2 Timothy 1:6, he urges Timothy to, quote, rekindle the gift of God that is within you through the laying on of my hands. For God did not give us a spirit of timidity, but a spirit of power and of love and of self-control. So that by way of a sort of biblical reflection on that passage. And just a final thing to throw out to you is this, that if you have time to go on through verses 9 to 21, that might be a good Bible study topic for a graduate fellowship. Just look at those verses and ask yourself what each of the injunctions in verses 9 to 21 would mean in very practical terms for you and your community as Christian scholars today. So that's just a suggestion for you to follow up later on. Okay, so I've spoken about the totality of our need for transformation through Christ and the diversity of gifts given to us by God. What then is the distinctive calling of the Christian scholar? The rest of this talk, and really tomorrow's talk, will elaborate this in various ways. And let me say by way of introduction here, that my basic framework, my basic sort of theological orientation, is to view scholarship from what I think is the broadest biblical panorama possible, namely the all-encompassing narrative of creation, fall, and redemption. That's a particular theological move I'm making, which I'll also be happy to defend, if you wish, over question time. It's important that you should know that that's where I'm coming from. That narrative of creation, fall, redemption is foundational for what I'm doing. And you'll see that in the points that follow. Okay, now let's jump into some more detail. Point two. The first point I want to make substantively in this regard is that Christian scholarship is a gift of God in creation. So I've suggested that Christian scholarship is one human vocation among others, and I've suggested that we can see it legitimately as a specialized form of teaching gift mentioned by Paul, although it's one normally exercised outside the church itself. And the point I want to make here is to emphasize that it's a gift rooted in our very creatureliness, in the design of our humanity. The practice which has today come to be called scholarship is not a happenstance. It's not just an arbitrary product of the modern Western world. As you know, scholars have emerged over time in pretty much every culture that's existed. It's present in every ancient civilization in one form or another. Obviously, the institutional expression of scholarship differs very, very widely from context to context. But scholarship is ubiquitous. It's everywhere in every culture. And I think we have to explain that simply because the gift of reasoning is a universal human capacity. And because the hunger for knowledge about the world is a universal human desire. These things are given to us, implanted in us, by God in our created nature. God has given us a powerful inner drive to understand the splendor and complexity of his created world by applying the uniquely human capacity of reasoning. Now, what I've just been calling reasoning is actually much wider than the very professionalized enterprise that we today call scholarship. In fact, the Bible hardly, if ever, I'd probably want to go so far as to say never, but somebody might pick me up on that, but almost never at least, speaks about what we today call reasoning or reason. I mean, if you look in a commentary or in a sort of dictionary of the Bible or whatever, you can do this in a second now on the internet, all kinds of resources, and key in reason or reasoning, you will get very few entries. And I would wager that when you look at them, they do not refer to what we today, in our post-Enlightenment age, refer to as reason, that very, very specialized activity. Rather, in almost every context, particularly in the Old Testament, but also in the New, the words that are used are words like wisdom, or understanding, or knowledge. And these terms mean something very practical, not theoretical at all. These are all practice, action-oriented words. So the wise person in the Bible, the person spoken of as with knowledge and understanding, is the person who obeys God by aligning themselves with the requirements of created order. That's what it means to be a wise or an understanding person in Scripture. The particular kind of reasoning involved in scholarship today is but one route to wisdom, or one form of wisdom. And so the first thing to say is that scholarship will be healthy insofar as it arises out of a desire for wisdom and obedience. All right, so what then is distinctive about this thing we call scholarship today? So point three. Scholarship, I want to suggest, is simply the search for a systematic understanding of God's creation. And let me spell that out. Scholarship is unique in that it is a highly specialized activity, following its own special kinds of logic. And let me add here that we know this not from the Bible, because the Bible doesn't give us an account of scholarly reasoning. There are all kinds of things that the Bible does not give us an account of, and this is one of them. We know this from human experience, a reflection upon human experience. This is true for many gifts and callings that God gives us. Just let me illustrate this. I mean, this may be very obvious to you already because you are actually doing it on a day-to-day basis, but let's just stand back for a minute and ask what it is we're actually doing when we engage in this very specialized form of reasoning. Take, for example, sociology, and compare what you might call the intuitive kind of reasoning that everybody engages in ordinary social life with that done by sociologists. So in ordinary life, most people function more or less successfully because they intuitively recognize social relations or institutions like families, friendships, and so on, and they intuitively sense or know or are socialized to understand how to behave within them or in relation to them. But the sociologist goes beyond that and seeks literally the logic of the social, hence the term sociology. And this involves a range of specialized rational activities. And let me just mention three of potentially many more. Abstraction. So, defining friendship, sociologists, unlike the rest of us in ordinary social life, go about doing things like defining friendship, families. And they do so as a general type of social interaction with certain identifiable and recurring properties, albeit assuming different forms in different contexts. That involves a process of abstraction. That's absolutely essential to the scholarly task. If you're wondering what I'm talking about, you do it all the time. As soon as you set about studying, you are engaged in, more or less, at some point in the day, one hopes, on a good day, the process of abstraction. Second, conceptual analysis and synthesis. Scholars distinguish and relate diverse concepts. Concepts referring to various realities out there in the world, in order then to develop things like theories, models, explanations, predictions, and so on and so forth, interpretations. And thirdly, deduction and induction. Now, you know, all of us do deduction and induction in a kind of a rough and ready intuitive way in ordinary life, but scholars do it in a very disciplined and systematic and intensive way. And again, every day you will be engaging in induction and deduction, whether you know it or not, whether you like it or not. That's what you're actually doing when you're sitting there at your desk. Again, on a good day. Now, I use the example of sociology, but what I've said so far I think applies to every discipline. It's just a characterization of what you might call theoretical activity, scholarly reasoning. Now, if you then wanted to talk about how this pans out in very different disciplines, of course very significant differences occur. For example, between natural sciences, social sciences, humanities, and historical research, and so on and so forth. But what I've said so far, I think, applies to all disciplines. So, scholars then are engaging in reasoning in a very systematic way. And they do it in order to gain systematic rational insight into some aspect of reality. Now, since for Christians reality is simply God's creation, I mean, there is nothing else than God's creation. Full stop. Everything we know, everything we experience, everything we could potentially imagine is creation. It's our all-encompassing environment and context. And so what scholars are doing is simply plugging away in this systematic, rational way at some or other aspect of that complex, phenomenal, spectacular, integrated thing called God's creation. So we can say, as Christians, that scholarship is engaged in the search for systematic rational insight into the designs and dynamics of created reality. Now, let me just pause for a minute and ask you, not to answer out loud or anything, but as I was just describing the last few minutes, what I think is the unique nature of scholarship, getting a little bit technical, talking about modes of reasoning, did you, at some level, begin to think that this is somehow a bit removed from your walk with Jesus Christ? Right? This is a bit dry. It's a bit cerebral. It's not where the action is of your spiritual life. If you had that feeling, don't worry. I have too in the past. Indeed, there's something about the scholarly task, this very, very intense, concentrated kind of rational concentration, which is often hard to integrate into, you know, the sort of dynamics, the worship, the devotion, the relationality of a personal walk with Christ. Well, I think that by relating scholarship to creation in the way that I just tried to do, we can begin to re-establish that connection between the very, very detailed, specific kind of work we're doing in scholarship and our personal walk with Christ. And I simply here appeal to the biblical doctrine that creation is upheld and sustained by Jesus Christ. Creation is not divorced from Christ. Christ is the wisdom of creation. Indeed, Scripture teaches that God created the world through Christ, through the Word, which is Christ. And let me just read to you a couple of passages which I'm sure will be familiar, but which always bear repetition. Colossians chapter 1, verse 15. He, Christ, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him all things in heaven and on earth were created, things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers. All things have been created through him and for him. He himself is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And Hebrews chapter 1, the first three verses. Long ago God spoke to our ancestors in many and various ways by the prophets, but in these last days he has spoken to us by a son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom he also created the worlds. He is the reflection of God's glory and the exact imprint of God's very being, and he sustains all things by his powerful word. So, when we get to work as scholars, when we apply our rational capacities in this disciplined, systematic way to the task of understanding creation, we are not walking away from Christ. We are walking towards Christ. We are coming closer to Christ, because Christ underpins everything in the creation order. Christ is already there, so he knows what we're trying to find out already, by the way. We can't surprise him, actually, with anything that we discover. But we are entering into a territory which is already saturated by the presence of Christ, because he himself upholds it and permeates it. And one important dimension of having our minds renewed, as Romans 1 puts it, is simply to have our eyes opened to the presence of Christ in the objects of study that we labour over day after day, month after month, year after year. We can perhaps imagine Christ sitting next to us as we go into the library, calling us to sit there, not to do something, but to sit there, to dig deeper, to persist, to stretch our rational capacities to their fullest extent, to put the gift of rationality to its full use in the service of Christ. All right, that's probably the longest section of the talk, better be, because time's going. Let me move on to point four. So that's creation. I'm now going to move on to the fall. If scholarship is a gift of God in creation, what impact does the fall have upon it? Well, scholarship betrays the deep and pervasive influence of the fall. What does that mean? Let's try and dig into that a bit. And I just list here three of many dimensions of the impact of the fall in the scholarly task. It's practiced by individuals, its reigning paradigms, and in its institutional embodiments. So, it's practiced by individuals. I mean, the effects of sin on the work of the individual scholar are just as pervasive as on any other area of life. And I'm sure we need little reminder. I won't spend much time on this. It's no great surprise, surely, that in our colleagues and in ourselves, we see all the usual vices displayed. Vanity, envy, greed, self-centeredness, indifference to colleagues, the desire to ride roughshod over other people's reputations in order to advance our own, empire building. I mean, the list goes on. You know that story. You see it. You live with it. And it's in ourselves as well, all those things. That's what you might call the personal or the behavioral impact of the fall on scholars, and it's nothing specific to scholarship. What about the intellectual effects? Ignorance about the source of truth, blindness to unwelcome facts, otherwise known as prejudice or dogmatism, closed-mindedness. Again, you know the list, and it's in all of us as well. So the fall affects the people that do the scholarship in all the usual ways that it affects any human being. Secondly, the fall affects the reigning paradigms, the broad governing theoretical constructs and schools of thought that dominate and guide the academy. The ideological biases. I won't say anything about this now because I'm going to expand on it much more tomorrow, so I'm going to skip straight to point three, the institutional embodiments. And I do this because as Christians we typically tend to be schooled to think critically about ourselves as individuals, but we tend not to be well schooled to think critically about institutions. This is a significant deficiency in the Christian mind. We are not natural institutional thinkers, and that's why very often we're so culturally ineffective. So we need to do that. We need to think about the institution that we are part of, that we are sustaining, you know, that pays our salary. Well, that does happen eventually, by the way, to some people. It's not all money out to them. It does come back eventually, for at least for the lucky ones. Well, some would say the unlucky ones these days, but... So what then are the distinctive pathologies of contemporary academic institutions? And here I just list four. It's extensive secularization. It's excessive professionalization. It's creeping bureaucratization. And it's growing commercialization. Actually, we could spend all evening on each of those individually. So this is just a very, very sort of broad bullet point sketch. We start just with extensive secularization. Again, I'm assuming that this is broadly familiar to you because this is the ambiance. This is what you live with day by day. Charles Malik, a very distinguished Christian academic leader from a previous generation, he's written a wonderful book called The Christian Critique of the University. Actually, I have it here. It's out of print now, but look how thin it is. Yeah. This is something that even busy postgraduates could get through in an evening, you know, on a train ride. It's kind of large print. You know. Being realistic here. Charles Malik, it's a wonderful book, written about 25 years ago, and still as fresh today as it was when it was. It's a tremendously courageous and bold statement critiquing the university. He speaks... uses the phrase of the swerving of the universities from their grounding in Jesus Christ. which is one way to describe the pervasive secularisation of the modern university. I'll just give you one example from another book which I recommend by George Marsden, The Outrageous Idea of Christian Scholarship. Anybody read this? Just the two guys? My two friends, that's right. Okay, well, hopefully next year, if I ask the same question, there might be a few more. This is a really good book, actually. Again, quite thin. Also available in paperback, yes. Good, right. So on page 6, he just says this is one instance, one anecdotal comment on the process of secularization that all of us are aware of. He just asks this question, referring to what he calls the puzzling phenomenon that among so many academics who are professing Christians, all but a tiny minority keep quiet about the intellectual implications of their faith. Why, and here's the question, why are there in mainstream academia almost no identifiable Christian schools of thought to compare with various Marxist, feminist, gay, postmodern, African-American, conservative or liberal schools of thought? Okay, do you get that? Why are there almost no equivalents? Actually, that's not quite true. There's one exception I'll mention in a minute, but only one that I can think of, actually. If one compares, for example, the number of Marxists in America with the number of Christians, the disparity in their visibility in mainstream academia is truly remarkable. What is it about the dominant academic culture that teaches people they must suppress reflection on the intellectual implications of their faith? That's just a symptom. That's not even analysing the cause. But it's one that I'm sure you'll all recognise to some degree or another. Well, at this point, if there was time, but there isn't, I'd sort of rehearse briefly a story that probably is familiar to many of you of, you know, the last few centuries, the impact of the Enlightenment and everything that flowed from that by way of dethroning Christian faith, theology, religious truth generally from its former position of preeminence in European and American and other institutions. And, the process went roughly like this, that first of all, the biblical worldview was relegated from its former preeminence as a set of merely subjective claims. Then it was pushed to the margins, which in fact today means pushed into theology departments. That's the only place that effectively stays alive, and there's some doubt about that as well. Some nodding heads there from Peter. Are you a theologian? You're nodding your head. Okay. And eventually, you know, excluded from the academy as strictly inadmissible in the modern secular university. And here, again, you know the story. This is the result of the elevation of autonomous human reason over revelation, of natural scientific knowledge over other kinds of knowledge, the discrediting of metaphysics as they're unverifiable, adopting a starting point of radical doubt as a basis for then acquiring the certain claims, the claims to certainty from which reliable knowledge could then be deduced. That's what's called foundationalism. So, altogether, you know, what we call the modernist project or the Enlightenment project, the attempt to strip away all subjective, particular, contingent, tribal claims and assert instead certain universal, rational, public, objective knowledge, which must therefore be secular. Oh, that's 2 centuries in 2 minutes. You can fill in the details, I'm sure. Now, of course, that whole modernist project is now radically questioned by postmodernism. And I'm sure that many of you already realise that this presents tremendous opportunities, tremendous openings for Christian scholarship. I think that's how we should initially view postmodernism, not as principally a threat to Christianity, but as a crumbling of the walls of modernism allowing other people to walk into the ruins and begin the work of reconstruction. That, I think, is how we should respond to that broad, complex, sprawling movement called postmodernism. And one of the temptations of Christians at this point is to react to postmodernism in a kind of instinctively negative and rejectionist way, and in doing so, ending up appealing to the same kind of modernist view of knowledge that dealt the death blow to Christianity in the academy 2 centuries ago. So we've got to avoid that mistake. And what we need to do here, this is an aside, I'm not going to develop this, is to develop a distinctively biblical view of universal truth over against a modernist Enlightenment view of universal truth. There are two kinds of universalism here that we need to distinguish. We need to take distance from modernist universalism and embrace a biblical universalism, which is very different in character. And the key difference in biblical universalism is that it accepts that the starting point of all claims to universal knowledge is faith, is some kind of religious faith. Now, Christians attached to the Enlightenment epistemology get very nervous at that point. Now, they want to be able to validate Christian truth by an appeal to some sort of objective rationality without explicitly depending or confessing one's dependence on an act of faith as the starting point of reasoning. And that's something I think we need to be very careful about, even while we also have to be properly critical of the sort of deconstructive, dissolving kind of moves that are going on in various strands of postmodernism. Okay, so that's 2 centuries in 2 minutes, and 30 years in 3 minutes. So again, this is broad brush stuff. Okay, so that's just a few comments about the extensive secularization of the university. By the way, we're still talking about the effects of the fall. Is that right? Yes, I think we are.
Yeah, we moved on from that. I'm losing my own track now. Where am I?
Yeah, we're still in the fall, actually. We haven't got to redemption yet. Hang on, we're almost there. Excessive professionalization. Actually, I'm going to skip these next few points because I think they'll be familiar to you. The drive to publish, to assess publication in terms of quantity rather than quality. The excessive specialization that results from that, which means that the results of work in one discipline or even one sub-discipline is almost unintelligible to scholars down the corridor in another sub-discipline, or maybe even in the same sub-discipline. This excessive specialization closes down communication within the academy, and it locks us into our own furrows of academic minutiae and prevents us from developing any larger interdisciplinary, cross-disciplinary frameworks for conversation. Creeping bureaucratization. You may not be quite so aware of this if you're just doctoral students, but once you begin to move a little bit up the ladder, it'll hit you in the face very quickly. I mean, let me just give you an anecdote. I've got a good colleague who is a leading specialist in his subfield, in a particular area of political science in the UK. I mean, really, he's really right at the top of the game. He's at a well-known university, and he's at the end of his tether. He's about to walk, because he's just had enough of the paperwork, the bureaucracy, the pragmatism, the disinterest in the search for knowledge on the part of his administrators, and he's about to walk. And I think there's a lot of academics out there who have walked or who are about to walk for that very reason. Sorry to depress you as you enter this world, but this is what you will find, and you need to be prepared for that, to anticipate it and to be prepared to challenge it and transform it in whatever ways you can. And finally, growing commercialization. Well, here, I have in mind here the fact that more and more research funding in universities comes from the private sector. Now, that I don't think is inherently bad, But it does create the risk of the subordination of research agendas to the special interests, particularly the commercial interests of funders. And you see this, for example, in funding provided by pharmaceutical industries or defense industries to various kinds of scientific departments, for example. And that raises a real question of academic integrity, which Christians should care about. It also raises questions of social justice, which Christians should care about as well. Okay, that's the four. Right? Point five, let's move into redemption and start to think a bit more hopefully. Christian scholarship can nevertheless, in spite of all that, be receptive to the transformative influence of Christ's redeeming work. Well, a few things about this. Obviously, this operates primarily through the presence of Christians, those who confess Christ as Lord, and who allow their work and their influence to permeate the context that they're in. But we should look at this with some hopefulness. You know, we feel like a tiny minority now in this huge, sprawling thing called the secular. What difference can we possibly make? Think back to previous centuries. Right back to the time of, say, the Church Fathers, just before Augustine came along, let's say. Christians were a small minority, a persecuted minority, barely finding their feet, just beginning to engage with the then secular academy, the pagan academy, and making initial forays into it, engaging with Greek, Roman thought, and so on and so forth. And then Augustine comes along, this towering intellectual, and after him, a huge development of Christian intellectual activity over centuries, involving 1, 2, 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000 Christian scholars. And over centuries, that had a massive transformative effect in the Western academy and Western culture. Well, so here we are, 40. Okay, so we're not one, we're not 10, we're 40. But, you know, there are many others out there as well. There are hundreds, there are possibly thousands of people who share our concerns in British universities today. And we need to find each other, work together, pray together, and hope for the future, that there might be ripple effects that will in the future have this transformative impact in the modern universities. One caution, and that is to say this, that we must remember that God's Spirit can do transformative work without us. In fact, it's just as well that God can do transformative work without us. Otherwise, we would be in the ruins and we'd never get out of them. We are privileged to be consciously committed, consciously summoned by God to be conscious contributors, conscious agents of that transformative work. But God's Spirit can work wherever He sovereignly wills, and He works through non-believers as well. And this, I think, prevents us from lapsing into a kind of Christian triumphalism or self-righteousness. And I think it means that we should avoid, for example, in speaking about our mission, we should avoid language such as conquering the modern university for Christ, or Christianizing the secular university. Christianizing, it has a kind of coercive element or connotation which I think we should avoid. Our goal is simply to be faithful witnesses to the universal lordship of Christ in whatever small situation we find ourselves in. And we leave the outcome of that witness to God. Well, moving on quickly. let me see. I think I've actually already, in the previous section, kind of pointed to the transformative, redemptive response that Christians might present to those pathologies, the defects of individual scholarly practice, the institutional embodiments, and so on and so forth. So I'll just leave that for our general discussion. Except for one point, which I just want to throw in. I'm sure you've discussed this on some occasions in the past, but let me just throw in a few thoughts. And that is this: whether one strategic response on the part of Christians to the deficiencies of the secular academy could be the formation of a Christian university. Some of you may have discussed this already or read about it. I'm not going to take a position on that now. I just want to throw that into the mix for our discussion. In that debate about whether in principle, never mind in practice, we're nowhere near the practice yet, in principle, something like a Christian university might be formed, we need to ask questions like this. Are the pathologies of the contemporary secular academy so deep, so pervasive, so confining, that the time has come to create an alternative institutional expression? That's an important question to ask. Or, even if that things aren't so bad, even if there is still ample room in the secular academy for Christians to be faithful Christian scholars, could there nevertheless be a case for creating a distinctively Christian university as an alternative form of witness by way of supporting the secular academy, providing a kind of alternative embodiment of a holistic, integrated, honest form of higher education that could, in subsequent generations, have a redemptive effect on the university as a whole? That's what happened historically in many sectors of society, in education, in medicine, in law, in lots of other areas. Just leave that question hanging. My final point. Christian scholars will occupy complementary vocational niches. And let me put the point this way. As Christian scholars discern our own vocations, they will quite naturally appreciate that there are a range of possibilities for them to discharge their responsibility as a Christian scholar. Some, on one side of the spectrum, will see their vocation primarily as immersing themselves in the secular academy, in the secular professional literature, within secular institutions, acquiring recognized expertise in that area in order to achieve a platform from which then to make a critical contribution as a Christian. Those people will probably largely publish in mainstream secular outlets. And their objective will be to do things like posing questions that others are not asking, suggesting alternatives to the reigning secular paradigms, and doing so, as it were, incognito, without necessarily showing your hand as a Christian. That's absolutely indispensable work. And in fact, I'd suggest that the real goal of any kind of Christian scholarly activity is indeed to contribute to the scholarly common good. It's to exercise a permeating impact on the community of Christian scholarship in the whole country, indeed in the whole world. It's not a goal of Christian scholarship to generate an intellectual subculture in which we just narrate our own perspectives to each other and nod encouragingly. If the gospel is public truth, so is Christian scholarship. But for that objective to be realized, in other words, for the Christian mind to have a substantive impact within the secular academy, it will be necessary for some Christian scholars to concentrate explicitly on foundational Christian perspectives. And that will involve a lot of hard work, often in isolation, often going back to first principles, rethinking the foundations of the discipline from the very beginning. It's lonely work, it's hard work, there are few resources out there to do it, and that may require a certain detachment from the secular mainstream. And here's just an example that comes to mind. Some of you may have heard of the Christian philosopher Alvin Plantinga. Anybody heard of him? Yeah, okay, yeah. Sorry? No, there's several more actually, yeah. The word's getting around. Alvin Plantinga is probably the most influential, well, let's say one of the top five most influential Christian philosophers in the world today. He has, in collaboration with a number of other very distinguished scholars, had a profoundly transformative impact in American philosophy generally, particularly philosophy of religion, but more generally in philosophy as it's practiced in the USA and deep beyond. Indeed, somebody made a calculation a couple of years ago that approximately 20% of American philosophers may be Christians as a result of the influence of Alvin Plantinga. That's a staggering fact, if that's true. I mean, it might be exaggerated, but even if it's 5%, that's a staggering achievement. And these are people who are actually, who mean it. They're not just nominal Christians who happen to be philosophers. These are Christian philosophers working out of the influence of people like Alvin Plantinga. But he developed his ideas from a platform into Christian institutions. He taught for years and years at an undergraduate liberal arts college called Calvin College in Michigan. It happens to be where my son is right now, actually. And then he moved on to the University of Notre Dame, which is his base today. So he's done all that from a platform within a Christian institution. And one could argue that without that institutional base in a distinctively Christian institution, he couldn't possibly have achieved that formative impact that he did. At least that's a debatable proposition. So some Christian scholars will need to accept the fact that they're not going to make it in the secular mainstream. They're going to take a different route. They may find themselves on the margins of the secular academy or in Christian institutions, and they are investing capital, creating capital, so to speak, that can be made use of by Christian scholars everywhere else. So that's a spectrum of possibilities. I just pointed out those are the two extremes there. There are lots of middle positions as well. And so I think a key task for emerging Christian scholars is to decide early on where you want to position yourself, where you feel called to position yourself on that spectrum, what your particular vocational niche is as you contribute to the larger task of being a transformative influence for Christ in the academy.